Accession number 14749, reel 2.
This is Mac, reel 2. So, did any bombs fall anywhere near you?
One. And just one bomb fell into the garden of this agriculture college. We had about 10 acres of ground around us. And we all stood agog. Actually, it happened during the weekend. On Monday, the following Monday, when we came back from to work and we saw it, and we just couldn't believe what we saw. But that was the only bomb that I ever encountered in our part at all.
What damage and casualties did that cause?
None. Then it happened, it landed in the garden, away from the house. Oh, it shattered the windows. It was no structural damage, but it shattered the windows. But that was more or less all there was. We had an aeroplane that came down, an American aeroplane, during this raid. And he shot one down, and he came very nearby, near this college. He came down. And he was taken actually into our school because it was the next building. Our college, our school was outside town, fairly outside town. So they brought him in, and we all were just standing there agog, you know, looking at this stranger from America. Nothing happened. They took him away in the end, I don't know where. But nothing really. That was just something new, something different.
Was there any hostility shown to him?
No, absolutely none. No, absolutely none.
So
not even by the police who picked him up. The police came and picked him up. No, none. No.
So you seem to have got off more or less scot-free from the Allied bombing.
Yes. Until, as I say, in 1944, and from then onwards, then it became much more, but confined to this place where these bombs were manufactured. Not so much with us, where I lived, 25 miles away. There was nothing really, not ever any bomb, nothing. Life went on as usual.
Were there any foreigners in your area in the war?
No. If you say foreigners, Tost had a... we used to have a place for the mentally handicapped, and that was... They were taken, done away with, we don't know where. And we had British civilian, 3,000 men in there who had come prisoner of wars, but there were very few in uniform. Some high officers, and we thought they might have been actually taken in Germany. I don't think they came from the outside much, because unless they were pushed down to this place, we don't really know. But in this enormous, great big place, there were about 3,000 prisoner of war. Stalag, whatever it was called, but mostly civilians, actually.
Internees?
Yes, internees. And that was in Tost, that happened in Tost. And they had a very good time. And it was a very nice story, I can tell you, because we used to go by sometimes, and they used to come from the windows when the girls were used to pass down to the football club. They used to shout to us and all the rest of it. Sometimes they even threw chocolate down. I think chocolate we didn't get very much, but we didn't look for it anyhow. We didn't have it, so we didn't miss it. But when I came to England in 49, and I was trying to learn, I went to evening classes to learn the language, and I was in Esher, near Hinchleywood actually, and on my days off, which were Wednesdays, I used to go down to Kingston and sat in a deck chair and learned had my German translation book. And twice a week I went to evening classes. And one Wednesday afternoon, it was very warm, and I went to sleep. And there was a deck chair attendant ringing the bell, waking me up when he wanted his threepence for the deck chair. So I gave him the threepence it was. And so he said to me, "Are you German?" I said, "Yes, I'm a German." "Oh, I was during the war, I was in Germany, I was interned in Germany." I said, "Oh, yes, you know, waking up." And so he said, "Oh," and he sort of went into dream. He said, "It was far away from anywhere," he said, "and it was a lovely little town." And as he was talking, I could see it was a town where I lived. You know, he was talking about that town. And he was talking about the breweries about the pubs he used to go and visit, he were allowed to visit. He was talking about the post office where he used to pick up the parcels, and it was across, the post office was across from our house. And it used to open at 3 o'clock. They came in a great big wagon every day from the Red Cross to collect the Red Cross parcels. And so they came along, and he said, sometimes we waited, and there was a very nice lady. There was only one house. And he said, I remember it so well because it was so pretty. He said, it was a cottage. They had wine grapes growing up there, and there were geraniums under windows. There were benches all along down there, and we used to sit there because it was so hot. And there was this lady who came out and brought us water because it was so hot as we were waiting for the post office to open. And he said, sometimes we went at 3:30, and we used to see, she had daughters, and we saw the girls coming from the train going into that house, so we assumed they were her daughters. Well, there wasn't anybody else but us. It was my family he was talking about. He actually came to pick up Red Cross parcels, and he saw us, and he watched everything. He described our house. He described my mother. He said he knew there were 3 girls, but he described the church, the old fortress, everything. Yes. No. So it was so strange, and my mouth must have dropped because I could see as he was talking, it was the town where I was actually living. He was talking about that town. And so no mentioned was, the town never was mentioned. So I said to him in the end, you don't mean Tost, do you? He said, yes. I said, I was interned in Tost. And so I've never forgotten that. It was so extraordinary that after all these years, and I came here to England, near in Kingston, and was sitting there, and this chap who was actually, who knew our family by sight, I will say, but he said they were very well treated in that camp. And what happened, because we did see them, there were no young soldiers. There were these old, elderly man, you know, they put into uniform. And so when those soldiers, these internees, came to pick up the Red Cross parcels, they were about 20, between 20 and 25. And so sometimes they used to go out for a walk. There was one soldier in the front, one of these old daddies, one in the back. When they came to the first pub, the two soldiers went into the pub and said to this to this man, you go on the way back, pick us up again. And they did. They had a lovely, it was very pretty round with us. We had a nice park, and it was a little bit hilly. So they had a little walk. Nobody ever escaped from there. I suppose they couldn't really, it was too far away. They had a nice walk, went up and down the alleys, the cherry alleys, and then they came back, picked up the soldiers, and they went back again like that. So life went on extremely quiet in our part of the country, I will say.
But what happened to those mentally handicapped people?
We understood they were done away with. They went to Oderberg. That's what we hear. They were they were going to Oderberg. That had a very large home, but I think it was one of the policies of Hitler's that they had done away with it because it couldn't be any use. They were only just small mouths to feed, and there was no chance that he could do that, probably money-wise or whatever reason, I do not know. But, of course, he wasn't very fond of people who were useless. Hitler wasn't, and gradually someone heard that he had done away with people like that. So we never knew what happened to them, except that they were removed.
So things began to change for you in 1944.
Yes, drastically then. Well, 1944, yes. And 1944, we went on until I was just before the war. Before Christmas. Yes, before Christmas. It must have been. I'm not so sure. I've been thinking about, was it before or after Christmas? And we went to school. I went to this agriculture college, as usual, in the morning. And we had, by then it was dangerous, becoming dangerous, through the news, in the news, we heard that the Russians were coming fast, approaching the border. Now, it was all very well organized until then. We thought they never come to us because there are too many German soldiers there, so we would stop them. But what they have done, of course, like they do, they went left pockets and went all around it and came like that. And we, five of us, we had to go every second day we had to stay the night and to be on a telephone, on telephone duty, to see the news, what happens to the Russians. And we had been warned, all the people around there in the villages and so on had been warned that the Russians are on the move fast towards the border. If they wanted to go away, if they wanted to go towards the right, they can do it now. But they were still hoping and giving us news all the time. We were very much informed every hour almost saying how far they have gone. And so anyhow, that very night I was on duty. I went in the morning. It was very strange. My mother came to the station with me, which she never did. And she, with my sandwiches, we went down. We started at 6 in the morning. And there were no more buses going, so I had to walk from 5 o'clock, and it was about 3 miles every morning. So I walked from 5, left home at 5, came to the station at 6 o'clock. We worked from 6 to 7 in the evenings, non-stop. Always have, except Saturday afternoon we had off. And so she came to the station and she said, and she cried, and she said, and so I said, well, I couldn't understand it. I said, well, it's no different into any other day. So she said, well, we never know if we'll see each other again. And funny enough, that was the last time I saw her for 12 years. Because we went, I went to the college, to the school. They keep saying college, it was agriculture college. And so in the afternoon, around about lunchtime, we hear that the Russians were actually going to come fast to our place. And so this, my boss, who had sent his wife the week before across the order, and he said, I've got a room for three in my car. If anybody wants to come with me, right, because do you remember there's the order, it's a very large stream. Everybody who was going somewhere, going over across the Oder, because it's such a big stream, we thought that's the end. No, the Russians won't come over so quickly. And that was rather a misconception, because they came just as fast. So I volunteered, well, I said I would be grateful. And so we went, and the snow in those days, we had very hot summers and very cold winters in that place. The summers usually started from the 1st of May and were hot right up to the 1st of October. From the end of October, the snow never went away until the 1st of April. It snowed and snowed and snowed and snowed on top of it, so it was very, very cold and very hot. There were hardly any seasons, you know, no spring, no autumn. And, of course, and then in December, it was so cold. And that's to say, even with the car, we had to push it half the time. The snow fell every day, every night, so the three of us. We came right to the, along the Oder, and then my boss said his family was there, so we're free to go now. And then we went our own ways, and that was a long trek. That was an extraordinary trek for me, because then I was on my own. I had nowhere to go. We had no relatives in the West except in Austria. All my family came from the East. So where was I going to go? We were just sort of hearing that the Russians were going fast, only by mouth. So you try to get away more inland. That was all we did, walk day, walk night. Many people had left, anybody who had, there were no cars. I don't know how they left or how, I don't really know, but it was extraordinary. Wherever you passed through, there were notices, no house was locked, all the front doors, all the doors were open. And so often you found a notice saying, take anything you wanted, feed yourself, take anything you want. Just like that. Nothing was locked. No houses were locked, even in towns. And so what we did, like me, being on my own, I had decided by then I'd probably go, I was just drifting. But we had to be fed. So we just walked into the houses, got some food, and I walked on. By then I was on my own. And you couldn't take any more clothes. I remember taking another cardigan from some wardrobe somewhere, because I was cold. And so I thought I'd take that one. But otherwise, what could you do? You took enough food, mostly apples or something that, you know, you sort of thought you would, or some bread. But if people left before, so there was no more bread left, there were these preserves sometimes you took along with you. So I started walking. And then, of course, as the Russians did come on, you know, very fast, and we walked on, they had camps in order to feed the people who were on the move, like me and... It was great hardship for lots of people. A lot of farm people came along. They were trying to get inland. Everybody was terrified of the Russians. Everybody was terrified of the Russians. I mean, we never encountered them, but we knew we were frightened of the Russians. and you saw them as I saw them too many times. They had sometimes these long wagons where they had this hay. When they had brought the hay in, with sort of, what should I say? Anyhow, these wagons and horses, if they had one, it was mostly cows. And they just took the children and some food and everybody and something to, some more clothes, just to go on along towards the west. And so many people got stuck in the snow and they couldn't go back. And there were dead people there, there were dead horses, there were along the road actually where I was walking at one time. There were dead animals, there were dead people probably too, stranded people, you didn't hear anybody, you didn't see anybody. It was sort of, sometimes for miles, it was just absolutely dead just dead. And so I walked along, it didn't affect me very much because I was young then, in a way, if I say, it was like a dream. You walked along like a dream. You didn't think anything, you just walked on. I often thought back what I thought. No, I didn't think anything. They just walked on saying, well, one day you'll come to a stop and everything will wake up. Anyhow, I came up and walked up, I don't know for how long, and I walked right up to near Dresden. Do you remember that date when Dresden was bombed? Was it in February?
Yes.
Well, it took me as long as that. It took me, I was the day before Dresden was bombed, I came up to Neustadt, which is not very far from Dresden. So it took me so long. We stopped here and there, and we stopped for a day, just waiting. It was the most extraordinary time. You just survived. You walked, you stayed, you walked on. There was no transport. The snow was high, so you stopped sometimes in houses, in cold houses. It was an extraordinary time. But we came the day before Dresden was bombed, and we came to Neustadt, which actually it's very near Dresden, and there was a big camp. And so I got to this camp and we had something to eat. We got sandwiches, we had a card, identity card, and so you had to say, where you were there, did you meet a camp before? You only got one lot of sandwiches a day, sort of, to speak. So anyhow, I came to a camp, it was very, very cold. And so I stopped there and I thought, well, I've been on the move now for nearly 2 months. Into where I'm going to, you know, shall I go further in? Or shall I go down, shall I make my way down to Czechoslovakia? Because Neustadt and Dresden, and then you go to Czechoslovakia, that corner. So it was sort of a point, am I going down into Germany? Or am I going down to go to Austria? So I decided I was going down to Austria, and it was the night before, I left the night before Dresden into. So often that when they bombed Dresden, and so often I thought, if I would have carried on, I would have got stuck in Dresden because that was my next stop. I would have got to Dresden. You remember that terrible, you made it faster. Well, it was a dreadful thing because there were mostly refugees in that town, really. So if I would have gone on, I would have probably gone that day and stopped in Dresden and probably would have not sitting here now. But I decided I was going down to Austria and through Czechoslovakia. Now that was another very dangerous thing because the Czechs hated the Germans. They absolutely loathed the Germans, German-speaking people, shall I say. So I only walked at nights. I didn't know the language, so I walked at nights only. And here again, it was bitterly cold, right up to March or so. I don't know how we survived. It was mostly apples. And I think I'm surviving until now. I can go three days without food. It was the way during that time I walked for nearly 4 months that the pattern sort of established itself. And we came to farmhouses sometimes when I walked along. If I say we, sometimes in the middle of the night, you saw somebody and saying, you know, sort of friend or foe. And it was mostly soldiers who tried to get into Germany. They came from all over the place, and when we said we're German, we walk a little way with you, and then they disappeared. We never know the names, they just disappeared, you see. And I walked up to, I came to walking up to Prague.
Were you still with your colleagues that you...
No. I left them when we came to the order. No, when I said I was on my own. When my boss came and picked up his family, we all dispersed them. No, I was on my own, completely on my own. I don't think, from what I could hear, from the others, you got stuck. You didn't want to walk anymore. But I'm a great walker. I found it perhaps partly adventurous, partly I was on my own and I'm pretty tough. I don't know what motivated me, but I just walked on and on and on. And so I came to Prague, and my mother was in boarding school in Prague during the war. Before the First World War, because my grandfather was specialized something in the industry about, I couldn't really tell you what it is, about something new in the industry, something in the coal industry. And he used to go, he was specialized in some special ovens. I don't know how I can explain it to you. And so they took him and another engineer. It was like an engineering one. But he was a specialized person. So they took him on 2 years stint when my mother was young, that was, from Silesia to Prague, to Vienna. He ended up in Spain, and then he came back again. Now, he shed his children at school, boarding schools, as he was after the 2 years. So my mother and her younger sister went to boarding school in Prague, as my parents... their parents went on to Vienna, and then they went to Spain, so the two boys were dropped in Spain. So my mother was very, I'm only saying that because my mother was very fond of Prague. She loved Prague, and she went to school there through the 2 years, and she always sort of, she spoke a little bit Czechish, and she sang to us in Czechoslovakian. And so when I came to Prague, and I saw it with the eyes of my mother, and I thought, I must get out in the daytime and see what it is like. So I crept out. You know, we slept under the railways. Mostly we found our way under the railway station. And we slept underneath, really. If they suddenly would have started rolling, we would have been underneath. That was the only hiding place we had in the daytime. And so I came down to this... I went that very cold, misty morning, and I went to the high street. It's the figure of St. Wenceslas, and you can see the road. And I stood there, and I thought, I'll just... tell my mother I stood there where she loved it so much. And that was the only time when we went back to the railway station. And suddenly I was lying underneath, and I saw feet going by. There were two soldiers. They were Austrians in civilian clothes, doing the same thing like I do. They were, as I said, they were all over the place, trying to travel at nights. Because the Czechs... they were very radical. If you spoke German, they put you away. They hated the Germans. They always had hated the Germans, I think, I understand. So anyhow, nobody wanted to encounter them. So that was a lovely evening that one day, and so when I saw them, I came out and made myself known. And so these two young men and I, and they said, it's so cold, and we were sort of huddling together, and they said, well, what is the disused train that just came in? Why don't we go into one of the compartments? It might be still warm. So we went in there, and you have no idea, whoever sat in there had left a small suitcase there. And when we opened it, there was a thermos flask of coffee, hot coffee, a cake, and two sandwiches. And we just sat there, and our tears were rolling down. We hadn't seen anything for months, for weeks, for months almost. We were saying that, and we said, all three of us, who's going to start eating first? And so we divided divided the food, and we had a feast where I thought it never tasted so good. And we had that one, and then we crept out again. So one of the soldiers said, why don't we go? There's a coal well, there's a good train with coal. Now, do you know what we did? We went to the end of it. There were tarpaulins over it. We dug a hole, and we dug sort of half ourselves into the coal, in the corner, because these wagons were going down to Austria. And we heard that these soldiers found out. And we stopped in Prague for two nights and 2 days. And then we heard this, we were looking for trains going south. And we heard that one of the soldiers thought it's going south to Austria. So he said, well, we go and dig ourselves a little hole. So I was almost up to here in coal. I don't know if they would have found me. I would have been able to get up because I was, in this wagon. And the two others were lying on top of it under the tarpaulin. Because when you came to the border, of course, they were checking everyone, every goods train, anything. So I did, we were down there and we were not seen. We went across, we went into Salzburg. We came actually into Salzburg. And that particular train, and it was the most beautiful morning, and it was about 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning, and people were going to work, and we stopped at the end of the platform, and there was, oh, that's what we actually did do before, that's how we got washed. You know, these things when they had the water pumps where they put the water into the big trains. So one was having that great big pump, and we were standing underneath and having a wash. And so we came along the platform. Everybody, we were filthy, we were dirty. But then I had a pair of soldier's boots on. I had sort of, I don't know, I was, I must have looked pretty ragged and torn, because it was, oh, we were in the same clothes as I left 3 months before. I mean, I hadn't had anything else except the washed here and there. So, and that, except my coat I shed, because by then it was March, and it was a lovely morning. March or April it was. I've forgotten now, because it took us so long to get across Czechoslovakia. And we came to the platform, everybody looked at us, and these two boys, who were then still with me the last part of the journey, and they were so overjoyed, and they were talking in Austrian, and they were telling the people what happened. They just couldn't believe it, because the people in Salzburg, they were very quiet. They hadn't seen anything of the war by then either. So they didn't believe us when we told them what happened to us. They thought we were making it up. They couldn't believe it. But anyhow, so these two soldiers, we parted company then, and I thanked them. I had no money or anything. So I don't know how I walked to Krems. It is from Salzburg, between Salzburg and Vienna. It's a lovely wine-growing country, and it's a part of a town, a lovely large town called Krems. That's where my uncle lived, and that's where I was making my journey to. You know, I wanted to go and see them. My uncle actually took over from his father. He was in the same position like his father was. So he was in Germany. He went around for 2 years in the same capacity, and he came to Krems, and then he went to the Steiermark. So he had the same 2 year stint like his father. I think it was the last of these sort of, they called him Obermeister, which is Uppermeister, but I think it died out with him. I think he's sort of engineer, because it is specialized engineer. And so he was in Krems. So I came to Krems, and I came and I knocked at the door, and there was no reply, and I could see there were no curtains. The lady next door came, and she said, "We moved yesterday. We moved down to the Steiermark, right down south to Vienna. To Austria." And luckily enough, she had the address, and she gave me money. So I put myself on a train, because it's a longish way down there, right down to towards Italy, you know, the Steiermark. And so I found them. No, I gradually found my uncle down there, and that's why I was reunited with them. I think by then it was April, and so it took me four months. It must have taken me from Silesia to walk to Neustadt, to Czechoslovakia, because it was only during the night, really, we walked more or less, except when I was still in Germany on these cold days and you couldn't go and move on. It was an extraordinary journey, a long journey, but one never forgets. And I often think, because perhaps I'm so tough when I was on my own, if I would have had my sisters, I don't think they could have survived with me, but I am tough. And I thought perhaps I was taking it as an adventure, or partly a survival, I do not know. But I just survived, and it was no hardship for me. I just thought it's just what happened.
And so then you were under the occupation of the Americans?
Yes, we were under the Americans. And I stayed with my uncle and my aunt for a month. And then we didn't know, we were all worried. And then my elder sister suddenly came along. And she came from Poland, and when I told you, she was in the kindergarten. And funny enough, it was a pocket where the German soldiers were, and they took her and her luggage, everything, across the Oder, and left her, and she found, sometimes through fluke, that some trains were going, sometimes soldiers were going, and she arrived in style, in train, the soldiers...